before we bring the panel up, I want to recognize somebody who's been very special to the Federalist Society and to the state of Florida, Richard Corcoran, who is our past Speaker of the House. He is a past Commissioner of Education and now the President of New College. Thank you for everything you've done. Where is Richard? Right here. Thank you, Richard, for all you do for our state. I'd like to ask the panel to go ahead and come up and take their seats. And I'll introduce our moderator for this evening, Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell. She is, of course, a judge in the Middle District of Florida. She was the first and only University of Florida law graduate to clerk at the United States Supreme Court for Justice Clarence Thomas. And we thank her for being here, and I'll let her introduce the panel. Thank you.
Okay. Are you seated?
Okay.
Well, thank you, Jason. It's my privilege, certainly, to get to moderate tonight's conversation with four very esteemed jurists. I had the honor of getting to introduce Judge Greg Katsas at this very banquet dinner 5 years ago when he interviewed Justice Clarence Thomas. Everything I said about him then still applies. Judge Katsas was really made to be a D.C. Circuit judge. His prior senior positions at the Department of Justice and the White House, as well as his private practice experience, really equipped him to hit the ground running seamlessly. I know that because I was one of his first law clerks, and I got to witness that firsthand. Judge Katsas remains a gracious mentor, and I appreciate his role, and we're always very happy to have him here in Florida. Next, we have Judge Barbara Lagoa, our native Floridian, on the panel. She holds many of the superlatives here. She's the longest-serving judge on our panel tonight, having been originally appointed by Governor Bush in 2006 to the 3rd DCA. She also was the first Hispanic woman and the first Cuban-American woman to be appointed to the Florida Supreme Court. And she now serves, at least in my view, on the most important circuit represented here this evening, the 11th. Lastly, she also hires, I think, some of the best law clerks. We've shared two, one of whom is in the audience tonight, and I hope more to come.
Brantley?
Yes.
Stand up.
But I hired the best law clerks.
We have to share them first, so. Judge Stephen Menasche serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and I believe this is his first time in the Florida FedSoc Conference, so welcome. Before being appointed to the bench, Judge Menasche also served in the executive branch, both in the White House and at the Department of Education, which is where we first got to meet each other when I was working for Rachel Brand in the Associate's Office. He also taught administrative law and civil procedure at George Mason Scalia Law School and was a partner at Kirkland & Ellis in New York. So welcome to warm and sunny Florida.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Judge Amul Thapar, who is returning to our conference again this year. Thank you for coming back. Judge Thapar holds the title as the very first appellate court nominee by President Trump in 2017. And he's also the only jurist here who served as a district court judge for many years before he was elevated to the appellate court. Judge Thapar's experience also includes being the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Kentucky, an AUSA. And on a personal note, he was very gracious to me when I inherited my docket as a district court judge and helped me figure out how to get a hold of your inherited docket. So we're happy to have everyone here tonight. Okay. In his first term, President Trump appointed 28% of the federal judiciary, including everyone on this stage and three of the U.S. Supreme Court justices. His appointments made it clear the kind of judicial candidate that he was seeking, someone who had the courage to interpret the law as written and not as what one wishes it to be. In short, he appointed textualists and originalists, and I use those labels kind of in the broad umbrella sense, as I know there's a lot of variations. So my first question for the panel tonight is, given that much of the federal judiciary presumably adheres to some of the same first principles, could you share how in past cases some of these debates might have manifested on your court when many are applying some form of originalism or textualism?
So I've kind of found that as somebody who's familiar with the debates over textualism, I tend to apply or to read a text less literally than a lot of my colleagues. That actually, there is a caricature of textualism that it is a kind of literalistic reading of a text. I remember one of the first en banc cases in my court, the majority cited Smith versus United States in its opinion, and you know, to show what the ordinary meaning of the word use is. And if people don't remember, Smith versus United States is a case that's kind of made famous by Justice Scalia for being an example of bad textualism. He calls it a degraded form of textualism that brings the whole philosophy into disrepute. It's the case where somebody traded a gun for drugs, and the court says, he used the gun in the commission of a drug trafficking crime, and so therefore gets the firearms enhancement. And Justice Scalia says, no, when you use a gun in the commission of a crime, you're supposed to use it for its purpose, which is a violent purpose. And so our court was considering the question of what qualified as a use of physical force against the person of another, and they quoted and they cited that case. And I said, no, I wouldn't agree that that was the ordinary meaning of the word use, for a lot of the reasons Justice Scalia identifies, which is that you have to understand words in context and as a phrase, and don't just pick out dictionary definitions and so on. And so I think, you know, kind of one of the debates that I see that comes up a lot is this question about how to read a text, whether it's a kind of literalism versus reading a text in context, and especially as part of the context, the kind of legal background principles that often inform the plain meaning of the text. And I think that is a difference between some of the people who are attuned to there are debates in textualism as versus older line judges.
Yeah, I'll say exactly the same thing in my hard case. As I yield to no one in how strongly I identify as a textualist and originalist, but I find it, you know, it's a way of framing issues and thinking about what I'm doing as a judge. It doesn't decide a lot of the hard cases. Right, and a lot of the hard cases arise when, as Stephen said, you read a word or a phrase that is what you're construing, and it seems to say one thing. Then you read the rest of the statute, you look at canons, you look at history, and things seem to cut in the opposite direction. So one of my more famous cases is Fisher, which was up in the Supreme Court last term, on using an obstruction statute against J6 protesters. And so basically the statute says, covers anyone who, I'll simplify a little bit, but destroys documents or otherwise obstructs an official proceeding, right? If you just sort of read the words, they didn't destroy documents. The statute defines official proceeding to cover the certification of the election results, right? And it was obstructed in the ordinary sense. It was delayed for several hours and such. And they didn't destroy documents, so they otherwise obstructed, right? The words just map onto what they did. And it's, you know, if you think textualism just reduces to slogans like any means any or things like that, it's an easy case the other way. Right, but it's actually a very hard case because when you read the rest of the statute, you get a lot of clues that point in the other direction. The destroy document is shorthand for a lot of other words in an earlier part of the statute, which don't do any work if you just say obstruct an official proceeding means what the dictionary tells you. So like, which way do you go on that? That's a very hard question. And then, you know, you look to history. Some of my clerks, you know, we've been taught to hate the word purpose. That's intentionalism or whatever. But like thinking through Fisher, it's a response to the Enron scandal, fixing what was called the Arthur Anderson loophole. And you go through all of that history, and basically what Congress was trying to do was make sure that people who destroyed documents could be prosecuted just like people who ordered others to destroy documents. That was a weird loophole. That's what they thought they were fixing. Like, you know, that, yeah, it's purpose, but it's just part of the background against which the statute was enacted. And, you know, I could have cited legislative history to prove that. People have a hang up about that. So I cited a Supreme Court opinion citing legislative history, but like, that's just part of the background that sensible speaker of English would have understood. So
informs the meaning.
To me, that's good textualism. but it's hard. And you've got to use all the tools in the toolkit. And I can't give you a formula for how to come out when, I sort of think in terms of percentages, like tax cuts 60-40 one way, but structure cuts 70-30 the other. What do you do? It's more art than science. I can't reduce it to a formula, but that's how I think about it.
Yeah, I agree with Greg and Steve. I talk about it to my clerks all the time because they get out of law school and they think there's a formula, and there's really not. I instead of saying I'm a textualist, which I do think of myself as, I say in chambers we're common sense contextualists, and that's kind of a combination of what the two of them are saying, is that you don't leave common sense at the door. And sometimes I look at the Supreme Court and sometimes some of them get so wedded to the words they forget about the context or my colleagues or whoever. And I often look at people like Justice Alito, who I think should get more traction in this circle, who has a common sense element to what he does, and he looks at the context and he brings a common sense element to the interpretation. And it's, Caleb Nelson's got this great law review, to go back to Fisher and Greg's great opinion there, is Caleb talks about legislative history and John Manning responds to him and says, well, legislative history didn't go through bicameralism and presentment, so you shouldn't consider it at all. And Caleb's point is neither did dictionaries or anything else textualists rely on. And so I think it's worth, we shouldn't leave every, like you shouldn't ignore the history of what the law, when the law was passed or what it was passed against. It seems insane for us to turn a blind eye to that. And yet so often we do, and we leave like common sense at the door because we wanna be so strict. And I think it's ridiculous to be a strict textualist in the way that people think of it and people portray it. You've gotta have common sense and you've gotta look at the context.
Right, so sometimes there's like different purposes that you might consult legislative history for, like to consult it and to decide that there's some unenacted purpose that the congressman had in mind would counteract the statute.
Right.
But it sometimes is a source for understanding the meaning of the words by a kind of contemporary, well-informed observer, like reading the Federalist Papers to understand what the Constitution meant at the time.
I agree, or if you look at like deer back in 1920 meant any wild beast. So if you think about it and look at the way the legislators were using the word to help you interpret it, it's kind of a form of looking at the entire, what's going on at the time to understand the law. But if you divorce the law from the time in which it's passed, in my mind, then you're also ignoring bicameralism and presentment because you don't understand what Congress and the president were doing when they, what they meant by these words, because words change meaning over time.
Certainly. And is this what the founders meant when they talked about like liquidating text? Or is it different?
No, I mean, I think that the contextual point is that you have to understand the meaning of the words in context. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at contemporary sources. So like Greg is talking about the mischief rule, that you could understand the text in light of the mischief it was aimed to combat. Or Amul is talking about contemporary uses of the same words. That is the meaning at the time. Liquidation would be as if it was kind of understood to have some ambiguity or some scope for interpretation that was uncertain at the time of enactment, but then over a series of adjudications or applications or interactions applying the law, it kind of becomes clear, they kind of settle on a meaning. So liquidation would be sort of post-enactment history, post-enactment source.
Yeah, I think Madison thinks of liquidation when he talks about it. And there's, again, some good law reviews about this. Caleb Nelson, again, I would point to, I know a lot of people talk about Will Bode's article, but I like Caleb Nelson's on this, but they're both very well done. But the point of liquidation to me seems to be, and I don't know that we should necessarily embrace liquidation in the way that some of the professors talk about it, but liquidation is if the text at the time is unclear, what happens over time to help us? It's kind of a way of thinking about things as it evolves, but I'm not sure that we should necessarily be doing that or necessarily give credence to that unless we're sure that it really was ambiguous at the time or people didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but I'm going to jump in and defend liquidation, right? I mean, you know, we get caught up in these methodological debates. The Second Amendment, this comes up a lot. Do you look to 1789 or 1868? And, you know, fine, those are great academic arguments, but I mean, remember Justice Scalia's Establishment Clause opinions. If you're trying to figure out whether the Establishment Clause prohibits Thanksgiving, right, it's very compelling evidence that from the framing to today, like, no one in the universe until Michael Newdow came along thought the Establishment Clause prevents anything like that. And, like, you can conjure up a case where a hypothetical where everyone in the universe thinks over time, like one day after the Constitution is enacted, that something obviously means X, you know, but the text was perfectly clear it meant not X. But like, that's not a realistic case in the world. So to me, sure, pre-enactment history is more important than post-enactment history, other things equal. But a long tradition of post-enactment history, for me, counts for a lot.
So would you agree with Justice Scalia and McIntyre over Justice Thomas, your old boss?
I won't get into it. I would look seriously to longstanding post-enactment practice. I'll just leave it at that.
Perhaps it matters how robust the practice is and uniform. So this is not liquidation, but question for the panel with precedent. So in many occasions, you're not writing in a first instance on a blank slate. So you're dealing with some sort of precedent, even if it doesn't directly control. So what is the role of both horizontal and vertical? So imagine some of the circuits have different prior panel precedent rules. How does that, how do you navigate a precedent that doesn't govern, but might suggest how you approach a case? How does that work in your circuits?
I think for the 11th Circuit, I don't know how the other circuits are, but we have a very robust case law where we do follow prior panel precedent very strongly. Obviously, if there's a case that's on point, it's a horizontal precedent, we're bound by that. But there are times when there's dicta.
And what do you do with the dicta?
Well, you know, there's dicta and then there's dicta.
That sounds like a Judge Carnes quote, I think.
it probably is. It's probably in the footnote somewhere. You know, the issue with dicta is if it's not essential to the decision and it's not in any way related to the issues raised or the arguments made or the facts in order to make that decision, it's really dicta. But there's dicta that can be persuasive and it can indicate whether for example, SCOTUS is going a particular way, so it's vertical precedent, but it's dicta. But it may be showing, maybe Justice Thomas writing a concurrence suggesting that in the future, this could be an area of the law that the court would be inclined to go into, so it becomes persuasive dicta. And maybe, I think as a judge on an appellate court, you then need to take that into a reasoned consideration as to whether or not it's applicable and you want to include it as part of your holding.
I mean, I wrote a case called Wright v. Spalding. I don't think dicta, although I agree with everything Barbara said because she's not saying it's binding. I think holdings are narrow because Article 3 requires us to resolve cases or controversies and that's all we resolve. So the holding and the necessary reasoning to the holding could be binding both vertically and horizontally, but nothing else, and everything else is just persuasive at best. And you don't know, like, everyone knows this, I'll go off on tangents in my opinions and just say, if this happened, then this and this, but those aren't briefed. Like, of course I want my court to treat them as binding, but it'd be ridiculous for me to think the court had to treat it as binding. Only the necessary holding is what's binding. That's all we're doing as Article 3 judges, as we're resolving a discrete case or controversy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we have written opinions, right? So like there was a time when you didn't really have written opinions by judges. You just had oral pronouncements of the judgment, and then you kind of had to figure out what the reasoning was if you knew the facts of the case. But we have a phenomenon called textualization of precedent, where we have written opinions for the court. And it does kind of seem to me that in that context, the purpose of the dicta holding distinction is to say, if something really wasn't thought out or considered by the prior panel or by whatever authority is binding, then it shouldn't be binding on future panels because it really wasn't part of what they considered. You know, but if the court goes on at length on some topic and really does articulate some considered position, for a later panel to come along and say, well, I can draw a logical flowchart of the argument that shows it wasn't necessary for you to write that, it's kind of like a lawyer's trick to sort of evade the prior precedent, right? Like, I would be offended if a subsequent panel tried to evade something that I had held in a prior case like that. So I tend to think of the anything binding that the prior panel regarded as part of what it was considering and deciding in that.
What if you say something is waived?
What?
The statement of the rule that resolves the case.
Right.
It's binding.
But if a subsequent court has a theory for why it was too broad a statement, or like it should be, like, unless there's some factual circumstance that would have made a difference under the prior panel's decision on its own terms, I would regard it as part of the rule of the prior case.
You would if a judge went off on a tangent?
Yeah, so I guess that's a little different. So if, in fact, what you're saying is it's pretty clear you're talking about other hypothetical circumstances, you're kind of speculating about it. Like, yeah, that's obviously not part of it.
Versus what? Holdings. What do you think are holding? Like, I agree with what Greg just said. It's, go ahead.
So, right, so dicta, you know, in principle, it's the stuff that's not necessary to the decision of the case.
Right.
Sometimes there's some disagreement about what's necessary to the holding of the case. And so what I think, you know, since we're talking about, you know, what the function of this distinction is, it's to not be bound by a prior panel's unconsidered decision, right? If they say something in passing. So like a famous example of this is drive-by jurisdictional rulings, right? Like sometimes the court takes jurisdiction over some case, but nobody really contested jurisdiction. In principle, they should have sua sponte addressed it themselves, but it was missed. And so if they didn't say anything about it, it was kind of unconsidered, then you don't regard that as a binding precedent. But if it's something that the prior panel addressed and thought it was part of the decision of the case or part of the rule, it seems to me that becomes binding on a subsequent panel.
You've all been on the bench now several years. Has your perspective changed on any of these topics as you've evolved in your positions?
On what, in precedent or?
No, just in how you approach your job.
I think my view hasn't changed from whether I was a practitioner to a judge. I think when I was a practitioner, the first thing I did was look at if I'm looking at a rule or if I'm looking at a statute or if I'm looking at a contract to see what it says. And I still think that as a judge, that's actually one of my pet peeves when I read an opinion and it doesn't tell me what the statute says or the rule or it doesn't give me what the contract language is. Because I think that's very important. So I think I haven't changed my view in terms of how I approach cases.
I've softened a little on the question of when to join other opinions and when not to. I came on, right, my North Star was WWCTD, right? You know, what would Clarence Thomas do, which Kat and I
had the bracelet, yeah.
Kat and I know very well. And he's famously and amazingly and wonderfully uncompromising. And he writes separately more than anyone, and he's changed the world and greatest living American, right? That was my ideal. For my job, for what I do, like I came in thinking like that, like, you know, things should be perfect, and it's really problematic when they're not. I strive for perfection. I hope my colleagues' opinions are. It's actually a little messier. Like, you know, what do you do when an opinion is, it's a little broader than I would have done it, but it's not wrong. It's a little narrower than I would have done it, but it's not wrong. It rests on ground A.
I would have done B, but A is not wrong. It's a little messier than I would like, but it's not wrong. I'm more willing to compromise in the sense of joining something that I would not have put out under my name. And I think that's consistent with, I hope that's consistent with WWCTD.
So the thing that I found most interesting that I hadn't really thought about a lot before becoming a judge is the dynamics of group decision making, right? So like we have to sit in panels of three, and maybe this is related to that, right? So like you have to draw a line as to
compromise.
You're willing to join some opinion, because it only becomes an opinion of the court if two people are willing to join it, and it's not going to be exactly the way you want it to be. And there's all sorts of interesting dynamics with getting to know your colleagues and so on. I used to hear these stories about how Justice O'Connor moved to the left when Justice Scalia joined the court because she found him abrasive and kind of off-putting. And I always thought, well, that's ridiculous. Why would you change your views on legal issues because you're like offended at the style of one of your colleagues? And now I find it totally plausible. That's how people behave, right? Like,
you're gonna name names.
You see these like interpersonal things, and you sort of have to get to know your colleagues' personalities, because there's some judges where if you write a long memo challenging, you know, their argument, they'll be like, "Oh, I hadn't thought about that," and they'd be open to persuasion. And other ones will dig in their heels because they think it's a challenge, and so on. And so navigating other personalities is a kind of interesting aspect of the job, and understanding what arguments will appeal to them and which wouldn't. And it's something I hadn't fully appreciated, but that kind of side of it is something that really makes a big difference.
And I think that one of the interesting things is when I joined the Third District Court of Appeal in 2006, I had an opinion that was sent to me, and I edited it. And that's not necessarily something that, and I edited it a lot. And that was like, I remember I received a phone call saying, we don't really do that here. and there is something to be said about that. When you're in a collegial body, it may not be how you would write an opinion, right? And you have to be sensitive when you receive an opinion from a colleague. And sometimes you'll be like, well, I can join, but I really need you to take off this sentence or this word, or maybe it's a little too harsh, and if you could, it'd be great, and maybe I can concur. But that's a conversation about being in a collegial body, and it's difficult, and you have to learn the personalities and who that's going to work with and who it's not going to work with, and it's just, you know.
Yeah, sort of a small example of that. There's a convention on my court that when you get an opinion from another chambers, you write back and you say, well, thank you for your excellent and thoughtful opinion. I just have these 25 suggestions for how to revise it. And I tend not to use extraneous adjectives and adverbs and so on. So I would just send these memos that says, thank you for your opinion, and here's what I think. And because everybody sort of expected all of the superlatives, they thought I was really harsh and like cold and like corresponding with them. And so I kind of just now say, thank you for your fine and well-reasoned opinion. You know, I really enjoyed reading it. I just have these 56 changes that you need to make. So that, you know, those kinds of things actually become important, because it just kind of affects how people react. And, you know, you're going to have to work with these people for 30 years or whatever. So it makes sense to understand how to relate.
Yeah, I find it to be the hardest part of the job. When I was a coming from the district court where everything you wrote was your own and you didn't have to worry about these edits and other things. And so I think I've gotten more like Greg only because what he talked about, only because I want less fidgeting with what I do. And if the judgment line's right at the end of the day, if I can avoid any catastrophic reasoning and the answer is right and the reasoning is not maybe the best, but it gets there, I'm willing to live with it, because hopefully they won't monkey with what I do. And that's kind of the standard I try to abide by. Like, would I want them doing it to me? I like Barbara, I have a very particular writing style. And so when I got to the court, I really wanted to edit everything. And I got some calls from, you know, friends of mine that said, you probably shouldn't do this. Just think about when they do it to you. And I took that to heart. And so now I both will suggest less, as long as everything, I can sign on to everything, even if it's not the best or it's not even great. But at the same time, I'll turn things down. I feel more comfortable turning things down because I do that, and so I can avoid too much monkeying with my opinion. The other thing I've learned is, you know, sometimes they'll make a sentence worse, but they're not impacting anything. Sometimes you just gotta live with it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's really tough. It's really tough when they do things and make your writing worse and you're like, oh my gosh, this is going out under my name. But you learn to live with it, because at the end of the day, it's judgments, it's reasoning, it's what matters, and you gotta put that first.
I think the hardest part is when you write the opinion and then you have the other two panel members who also have edits, and then you try to sort of thread the needle so that you make everyone happy, and you are, you know, thinking this opinion is getting, my writing is going out, and it's very different to have to manage a panel of three and everybody happy, make everybody happy.
This is somewhat off script, but how do you decide when to publish? Is it just the panel decides in each of your circuits? Or is there any sort of protocol?
For the 11th Circuit, normally if it's an oral argument case, it's published, unless the panel decides that it's not going to add to the law, and then we decide not to publish.
But y'all have an exceedingly low oral argument, comparatively, the Second Circuit or the D.C. Circuit.
So that's normally when we publish.
Yeah, we don't do an advanced screening for oral argument. Like, I think most circuits, they screen all the cases before they schedule argument and decide whether it justifies an argument. But our rule is if a party wants to argue, we will give them argument time. I think we give them less time than most circuits, so you get 5 or 10 minutes per side, although we will keep you longer if we have more questions, so it's not really a fixed amount of time. And so the rule about publication is that what we call a summary order, which is an unpublished opinion, it has to be unanimous, and it doesn't have an author. It's just written on behalf of the court. And so if somebody wants a dissent, then it has to be an opinion, or disagrees to some extent, has to be an opinion. If somebody just wants an opinion because they think it's justified in that case, it has to be an opinion. And that's kind of the rule that we follow. And that leads to some kind of awkward dynamics, right? Because if you insist on an opinion, you're imposing more work on, you know, your colleagues, because the summary orders are shorter and, you know, less revised and so on. And so sometimes maybe, you know, there's a disincentive to do more opinions or to dissent because you're imposing that work. And then there's these strategic considerations about should you join something to make it a summary order so it's technically not precedental, and the hopes that, like, later there will be a precedental opinion. I kind of think the unpublished opinions practice is under-theorized. Like, there are all these issues with the distinction between published and unpublished opinions that I think are problematic. So I try to treat unpublished opinions respectfully as real opinions, that if we're going to say something that departs dramatically from something we said in an unpublished opinion, especially if it would be a different outcome, we should at least explain it and take account of it, because those are real decisions that the court has made that had an impact on the parties. So I've thought somewhat about the unpublished opinions practice, but ours might be unique. I think in other circuits, usually unpublished opinions look just like regular opinions. They have an author, and they might have a dissent and so on. They're just designated as unpublished.
Normally, if it's unpublished, it's not a dissent. If one of the panel members disagrees, then it's going to go to oral argument.
Well, turning to a little bit more of a somber note, we've certainly seen an uptick in threats towards the judiciary, both figurative and literal. We're all aware of the many, such as the one against Justice Kavanaugh, Judge Salas in New Jersey, and then Judge Cannon, who I think is here with us this evening. Do you have any thoughts as to why we're seeing this now in our history?
I mean, I can't tell you what's driving it, but what I can tell you is that I think that one of the things that the public should consider is that, you know, in our constitutional system, we, as the court system, we get a lot of cases that could be controversial or hot button issues. And I think that right now there's a tendency to think that when an outcome happens, instead of, I don't begrudge anyone from criticizing an opinion that I wrote or that I joined. But I think that there's a way to criticize it to say maybe the analysis is flawed, or I don't agree with what the outcome is, and the analysis was just not how I would have done the analysis. But I think what happens is that there's this sort of presumption that the judges are acting with bad motive or bad faith, as opposed to we're doing our jobs and reaching the decision that we think is appropriate under the Constitution. And I think that's where sort of the disagreement is, or this public misunderstanding of it's okay to criticize an opinion, but you shouldn't personalize it to the jurist or the judges who are in favor of a particular opinion.
I mean, this affects me probably least of all. My case, I have ad law cases, and you know, there's some lawless agencies, but they don't make threats against the judges, and some regulated industries, and they don't make threats against the judges, right? But the judges below me on the district court who have had all these edgy, Trump adjacent, you know, highly politically charged cases are under threat. One of them has a security detail 24/7, and the judges above me, as you know, I mean, it's outrageous how the Supreme Court justices have to live now. They can't go out in public. They need security 24/7. Justice Thomas is lucky. His house is far enough back that the lunatics can't get within shouting distance, but Justice Barrett isn't. She's on a cul-de-sac, and Justice Kavanaugh, right, in the hotbed of craziness in Chevy Chase. It's outrageous. And the people, you know, lunatics at their house, they haven't been prosecuted. It's got to change.
I had a kind of... thought about the dynamic, which is, I wrote a paper recently about how Congress is legislating less, and because of various incentives wants to do things like oversight more and make public statements and so on. And so that means that's kind of the congressional response to judicial decision making is less passing laws that might fix things the way they want them and more sort of yelling at judges or casting aspersion on court decisions and so on. And so what it means is actually a lot of controversial issues get punted to the courts, and then politicians, instead of, you know, addressing the laws, are criticizing the judges and so on, and that's a kind of unhealthy dynamic. And so maybe one solution might be if Congress legislated more, and then the judges would be doing less, would have to resolve fewer controversial social questions, and the response would be less criticism and more, you know, democratic participation in legislative decision making. Like, I remember, you know, I sat for one of the days of the Kavanaugh hearings, you know, the first phase of the Kavanaugh hearings, and every so often somebody from in the gallery would get up and say, you know, if he gets confirmed, you know, my family's going to die because he's going to declare health care unconstitutional or whatever it is. And then the senators would sort of wait for the security to clear the person out of the room and so on. But the person in the gallery was just kind of saying exactly what the senators were saying from the dais about how people were going to die because he was going to declare statutes unconstitutional and so on. And so, you know, a lot of the rhetoric, you know, maybe is not meant to be taken that seriously, but that is kind of the way politics interacts with the courts in recent years.
Yeah, I think it's one of the unique things is you're talking to four people that probably at the appellate court, we have, in some sense, the least worry about our security because we're more anonymous. I think district judges, having been a district judge, I had a hit on me at one point. You know, there are different things that go on when you're a district judge. You've got criminal defendants in front of you. You've got crazy litigants. It's ironically rarely the criminal defendants. It's more often the crazy litigants. But you have a lot of that. And what's going on with the Supreme Court's beyond ridiculous. And I think the bar has to do more, not for us, and not even for district judges, because the marshals really do a great job of handling most of that with district judges. It's unseen, but I would commend the marshals for everything they do. But the Supreme Court, like Greg said, it's insane they can't go out. And there's not enough people speaking up about it, in my opinion. There's not enough. You talk about judges with courage. We also need lawyers with courage to stand up in front of the microphone and say, this is insane that Justice Thomas can't go to a restaurant. You know, they shouldn't have to live this way. And so I definitely think that's more necessary. It's more needed. The hits on, you know, Justice, the attacks on Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, I mean, it just never stops, right? Because no one stands up and says, this is crazy. And I think more and more people need to do that.
Well, turning to your experience before you joined the bench, each of you served in public service, in some of you multiple ways. How did those roles prepare you for your current post?
Well, I think that before I joined the bench, I had a varied and diverse litigation practice. I practiced civil law for a long period of time, and I did a lot of different cases, complex commercial litigation, securities arbitrations, construction litigation. But at some point, I decided to go into public service, and I was lucky enough to be hired as an assistant United States attorney. And there I was fortunate enough to be able to do a lot of criminal trials and criminal appeals. And I didn't plan sort of this trajectory, but when the opportunity arose there was an opening at the Third District Court of Appeal, and that opportunity arose, I really was prepared for the kinds of cases that the court was going to handle. And so the trajectory from the Third District Court of Appeal to the Florida Supreme Court sort of prepared me very well for the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. When I joined the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, as you know, there's a lot of diversity cases, there's a lot of state law cases that come with diversity cases, and so a lot of insurance cases, and that's sort of like the bread and butter of the Third District Court of Appeal. So I was very well prepared for that. And I think as a result of my being a justice on the Florida Supreme Court, one of the things that I believe very strongly in is that state Supreme Courts are the final arbiter of state law. And so I think that one of the things I really try to persuade my colleagues to do is to certify cases to the Supreme Court. So whether it's the Georgia Supreme Court, the Florida Supreme Court, or the Alabama Supreme Court, because I really do believe very strongly. Sometimes I may not agree with the answer that we get back, but it's state law, and they're the final arbiters of state law. And so that's one of the things that I think that sort of helped me be able to be very confident in doing that with certification.
I'll talk about two government jobs. My first government job was running civil appellate at DOJ, and that was great preparation, just working on a lot of cases in the DC Circuit. Not hugely different being a litigator, being an appellate litigator from being an appellate judge. Writing briefs is somewhat similar to writing opinions, and prepping for argument is somewhat similar, depending on what side of the mic you're on. Obviously, in one role, you're an advocate, and in one, you're a decision maker, but good advocates have to figure out the weaknesses in their cases and the answers to the hard questions. So kind of working through cases like that, that was great preparation. And so was my job at Jones Day, doing, getting my brains bashed in, losing Engel progeny appeals down here in Florida. Things are better now. My last job in government was the worst possible preparation, which was the White House counsel job. You could not imagine a job more different from being a Court of Appeals judge than being a deputy White House counsel in the Trump administration, right? We get on the court, the work comes in, we get the schedule a year ahead, we get the cases 2 months ahead. It's a heavy workload, but it's predictable. I manage my own time. If I'm not sitting and I have a family commitment or I want to structure things a certain way, I just do. I mean, the White House is just crazy. It's, I decide maybe 60 merits cases a year, something like that. The White House, you're working on 60 matters in 3 days. Everyone needs an answer as of yesterday. Just chaos and a lot of work at the intersection, and not just law, but law and politics and policy, and you're just sort of juggling a lot more variables than we do now.
So
sounds like a district judge.
Yeah. So in addition to the White House, I was an agency general counsel, as you said before, because I was the acting general counsel at the Department of Education. And I always recommend to law students that they should consider working in the agencies. That's where the government meets the public. And so you have the task of implementing policy on the ground and making it real, which is its own kind of unique challenges. But it gives you an appreciation for how the government works. And especially as someone who had been an administrative law professor, to then actually engage in a rulemaking or an adjudication and run the legal department of an agency was kind of fascinating. And you know, there at least was, when we had more robust deference doctrines, a kind of type of law review article of administrative law professors, which would talk about how you could manipulate deference doctrines to win cases and so on. So I tried some of that to see how it would work in the real world. And it didn't always work, because sometimes you need to convince the DOJ to make an argument they don't want to make because you can't, you know, write the brief yourself and other things like that. So I found it interesting in that way. And I think in terms of preparation for the job, I mean, when we have cases that involve the government or knowledge of how the government works, it seems to me, you know, on my court, I'm really the only one who understands the dynamics of agency decision-making, how agencies operate. Maybe it's more common on Greg's court, but on mine, it's less. You know, there's like a small example of this, as I remember, we had a FOIA case, and one of my colleagues on the bench said to the lawyer for the government, you know, if you just added one more person to the two people working in the basement on FOIA requests, you'd do this in a much timelier fashion. And like, I know what it takes to run a FOIA operation of a federal agency. And so I said, you know, do you in fact only have two people working in the basement on FOIA requests? And the government lawyer says, no, we have a $15 million contract with a vendor to process all of these cases in the agency. Like, they don't really have an appreciation of what it takes to run a government agency. And I think I, you know, bring that to some of the cases that we see in our court.
Any experience you wish you had had that you didn't?
No. Sorry, what?
Any experience you wish you had before you took the bench? Well, there you go. Follow their paths for all the young lawyers out there. Okay, well, I want to thank all our judges for sharing with us tonight and being with us this evening. I have a toast. I know we only have water, so somewhat sad thing to toast to. But to close out this evening, I thought I would honor Chief Judge Pryor's tradition. So I'd like to propose a toast to the United States Constitution and to 4 more years of appointing judges like these who defend it. Thank you.